My name is Carol Barnett, and with my husband Ted, I am one of the coordinators of the Rochester Area Vegetarian Society. And we are very fortunate to have as the speaker for our Sunday, March 16th meeting here in Rochester, New York, Pamela Rice. Pamela Rice is someone that I first met at the Vegetarian Summer Fest, and I became aware of her as kind of an extraordinary activist, somebody who lives her entire life as an activist. She founded the Viva Veggie Society and the Vegetarian Center of New York City, and she also published a pamphlet called 101 Reasons Why I'm a Vegetarian. And this pamphlet evolved in many different editions over the years. It became more and more comprehensive. It was constantly updated, and it was distributed to hundreds of thousands of people, many of them in the New York City area, and it was recently published as a book, which you see here before you. And Pamela herself has been known to engage in street theater to directly greet and engage the public, and she is sometimes known as Penelope Pod. And I have here some vintage issues of 101 Reasons, which have pictures of her dressed as Penelope Pod. So I'll pass them around so you can see her in costume. And she, I know she will tell us about this. She is currently organizing the first Veggie Pride Parade in Greenwich Village, which will take place on May 18th of this year. So without further ado, I want to introduce Pamela Rice, and she's going to tell us about being a vegetarian to save the environment, five reasons that you never thought of or knew about. Please join me in welcoming Pamela Rice.
Absolutely wonderful to be here. I've heard of the Rochester Area Vegetarian Society for many, many years, and I always heard that it was a very, very well-run vegetarian society, and I can see that right away. I also knew, my husband and I knew right away we were in the right place because we saw all of those bumper stickers. So we're in the right place. No, we're not lost. if folks are interested in the Veggie Pride Parade, it is May 18, and I have a bunch of flyers right over here, and they look like this, so go ahead, feel free to pick one up and take one, and even post it in your, you know, the local grocery store at your school or community college or church or wherever you go. I think Carol pretty much covered my biography. She maybe didn't mention that I also published a magazine for 50 issues. So I do indeed live and breathe and pretty much all the time vegetarian issues. For me, there is like no reason not to eat meat that I don't know about. And I feel that this is a very sophisticated crowd here. Many of you have probably read lots of vegetarian literature. You're familiar with John Robbins, and Diet for a New America really covers a lot of information. And you're familiar with the general reasons why it's not a good idea to eat meat. But I will kind of go over some of those general reasons. In the environmental sphere anyway. Two things. It's eating animal-based foods is very wasteful and it's very destructive to the environment. It's wasteful, as we know, because you need a lot of grain to feed to the animals to get just 1 pound of flesh. Particularly with beef, we know that it depletes forests and it uses hordes and hordes of water. About 70% of all the water that is used for, that is fresh water, you know, from fresh rivers and lakes, goes to agriculture. And in our country, at least, agriculture is animal agriculture. Depletes topsoil. So it depletes resources, and at the same time, as I mentioned, it's destructive. It's it pollutes the water and the land and the air. Manure is a huge problem today on factory farms, and CAFOs, confined animal eating confined animal feeding operations. And apparently there is some, I just read a new fact today, and I don't come across new facts too often that might go into my 101 reasons. Apparently, livestock in America produce about 13 times the manure that the human beings do. 70% of all grain in America that is cultivated, this is goes to feed animals. I'm going to return to that fact repeatedly in my talk here, which is indeed five reasons, five environmental reasons that you probably never heard of, unless you read my book, by the way. I'm going to assume that you have it. They are fertilizer runoff. We're going to talk about that. And pharmaceuticals in the water, pharmaceutical pollution. Mortalities, what do we know about those? It's an industry term, mortalities. And fish stocking programs in our lakes, our freshwater lakes all across the country. And dust. These are issues that pertain to, that indict the meat-centered diet. Now, there's a lot of contaminants that go into the water from confined animal feeding operations. Again, this is an industry term. You know, we vegetarians call them factory farms. There are pathogens of all kinds. Actually, it's mostly in the manure that ends up in the water. Wormy parasites and little buggies that can make you sick. Pesticides, antibiotics, and heavy metals. And you may have heard of some of these pathogens. I'm going to talk about two that are maybe a little more obscure. Nutrients and the pharmaceuticals. And first of all, you know, there is something called nutrient pollution. How many people have heard of nutrient pollution? Interesting. It sounds like an oxymoron, right? It sounds like an oxymoron, and it is. It's another one of those kind of double speak that we hear from the meat industry. It is now nutrients are a good thing usually, and often they are in agriculture. Nutrients come from manure. Nitrogen comes from manure. You want to put manure. You know, you want to take your manure from your cows over here, and you want to put it on the crops over here, and that's kind of a symbiotic relationship that worked for forever in farming. You know, but today we have confined animal feeding operations so that there's too much distance between the grains and the animals. So you've got lots and lots of these nutrients, i.e. manure, in one place. And that is always a problem when you have too much. The manure actually collects in things called lagoons. Lagoons, there's another euphemism from the industry. And these lagoons will leak and they will spill, and particularly manure will also be spread over on land. They have to get rid of it. There's just so much of it. In fact, the statistic from a Senate report that came out in 1997 from Tom Harkin, Senator Tom Harkin, said there is 1.3 billion tons of manure that's produced every year by the animals. And It's collected in these lagoons sometimes, which is a major problem, and that doesn't go back to the land. And then sometimes it's spread over land, but it's overspread too much. So then it ends up trickling down over the years and turning into something called non-point source pollution. It's not like a pollutant that comes with pouring out of a factory. It's something that just trickles into the environment slowly after many, many years, so you can't really get a handle on it. So nutrient pollution is basically too much nitrogen, too much phosphorus. These nutrients, these pollutants are not, they're not confined. They get into the environment, and they in large quantities and large concentrations, they are truly a pollutant. If you think that nutrient pollution is not a serious problem, the United Nations Environmental Program. Whoops, that's okay. Klaus Toffler, he warned that humankind is engaging in a giant global experiment as a result of the inefficient and often overuse of fertilizers. And fertilizers, actually, it's not just manure, although manure works the same way, there's tons and tons of manure, but we are also producing petrochemical fertilizers. We're actually making petrochemical fertilizers, they're basically synthetic fertilizers. Okay, hang on a minute.
Okay, the question I got is with regard to nutrient pollution.
Yes.
Is that the problem that it creates specifically, is that the weed growth, for example, and waterways and so forth? I remember the pesticide runoff being a potential problem.
Yes, any kind of nutrient in the environment and if it gets into the waterways, which eventually that's where it gets, but it also pollutes the land and it even pollutes the air via ammonia that evaporates from these gigantic lagoons. And it's a nutrient that causes things to grow. That's why you put it on your crops. But it also causes bad things to grow, like algae in the water. And it chokes off the oxygen and kills fish, ultimately. So I'm glad you asked that question to clarify that. But ultimately, this gentleman from the UN Environmental Program, he's basically saying that we're involved in this global experiment. Nutrient pollution is a global problem. And it causes basically two things. It causes these red tides, where an entire coastline becomes red with these tiny microorganisms that are choking off the oxygen from the water. And he basically says that also the other thing is is dead zones, where oxygen is completely robbed from the bottom of the bay or the ocean. And we have a gigantic dead zone in the bottom of the Mississippi River, at the end of the Mississippi River. So that's a little better than standing here. But anyway, nutrient pollution, it's basically what you might call too much of a good thing. You want nutrients. Everybody puts fertilizer on their crops. They put it on corn crops so that their corn grows. But ultimately, it just turns into manure. And like I say, they're also creating lots and lots of nutrients on top of, the manure that we already have with these petrochemical fertilizers. So it's basically disrupting the entire nitrogen cycle. I mean, that's what we're getting for this global addiction to animal-based foods, which is basically our Western way of eating. Lots of animal-based foods is being exported to the rest of the world as well. and we have these dead zones where you have the oxygen is robbed from, you know, the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, for instance. Is a giant area about the size of Connecticut, no less, that once a year turns devoid of life because of all these nutrients that literally come down the Mississippi River. So remember that one, the dead zone, you know, and there are dead zones, in fact, all over the world now. There are about 130 of them. And life just cannot live there because oxygen is cut off from animals who can't swim away, they can't run or crawl fast enough, will die. We have nutrient pollution in the Chesapeake Bay, in fact, which last I heard is going to cost $19 billion to clean up. And all that nutrient pollution is coming from the Delmarva Peninsula primarily, and I think even, you know, other parts of Pennsylvania, there's farming going on, and the nutrients are, these manures being spread, and then over many, many years, as rainfall comes down, everything eventually ends up in the water. And so the Chesapeake Bay, there are underwater grasses there that are being destroyed, basically by animal agriculture. Now, nutrients come in the form of ammonia as well, and they travel through the air, and they also fall down into waterways and, again, kill fish. It's, again, too many nutrients. That leads me to the next one, which is pharmaceuticals in our water. And perhaps some people have heard about these pollutants. If you drink a lot of coffee, if you take birth control pills, if you take other pharmaceuticals, they often go, pardon the expression, right down the toilet. I mean, literally. And they survive any kind of purification process at purification plants, and they actually pollute the environment. But it's not just human pharmaceuticals that do this. It's also all the pharmaceuticals that are given to the animals that we eventually eat. And in particular, hormones and certainly antibiotics. And there have been studies where they find that the wildlife downstream from one of these feedlots, these confined animal feeding operations, euphemism, where these factory farms are, downstream from there, you will see that the wildlife actually has ingested in like parts per billion, literally parts per billion, teeny tiny amounts that actually affect their endocrine systems. And it's called, you know, endocrine disruptors, they call them. And so this is yet another type of pollution that animal agriculture is giving to the world. So just want to congratulate everybody here who is a vegetarian, because you do not contribute to this kind of pollution. Right. It's very funny how the media works, and I watch it so intensely, and I've got like these feelers, radar, you know, going up. Are they going to mention the vegetarian issue? And it seems so often that they stop right short of talking. That the meat-eating world really doesn't want to be challenged. It doesn't want, and this kind of information would challenge their meat-eating lifestyle. We talk about coffee and birth control pills and things like that, which are a problem, you know, that are going down into the waterways and disrupting wildlife. But indeed, also the hormones in animal waste.
Is it many times more pharmaceuticals from animals than from humans?
The studies are really, you know, very vague, and the industry, actually the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, I was just reading this morning that they challenge any kind of research, of course, that points to this. They even say that it's the Europeans who are funding this kind of research to try and find pharmaceuticals from animal operations. And they say, well, you know, those Europeans, they keep trying to prove that hormones in beef are dangerous to human health because they, in fact, will not accept any beef in France for sure, in most of Europe, I guess, all of Europe won't accept beef that was where the animal had been implanted with a hormone. What they do is they take this little thing and they put it on the animal's ear, and that's how hormones get into the body of the animal. And in fact, I was just reading a statistic this morning that 90% of all cattle in America are in fact implanted with these with the hormones. And the Europeans, like I say, the Europeans won't accept beef. That they won't accept our beef. That is like that. You were going to say?
Well, not just in the beef, but in the dairy.
Right. Oh. Yes. Right. It's a different kind of hormone, I guess it would be. Anyway, what they found with the research is really, really sad. They found that these hormones, when they get into the wildlife, in particular a certain species called a fathead minnow. And this species of little fishy, when it gets these hormones in their bodies, the males become sort of less male. And the females become less female. I mean, and they measure this by actual testosterone in the animal, and they even testicle size, and with the females, the amount of estrogen in their little bodies. And so obviously, if you disrupt the sexual function of a species in the wild, that species is going to have a very difficult time surviving. So, I mean, just carry that out, and this fathead minnow apparently is something called a sentinel creature. That is, it's sort of like the canary in the mine shaft. I think frogs are another sentinel. I mean, when you see them faltering, you say, boy, there's more to come. You know, there's other animals that are also going to be disrupted in this way. Let me move on to a really fun subject, dead animals. You know, when you're talking about animal agriculture, it's always, it's an unsavory conversation. It's things you don't want to talk about in polite society. You know, suddenly you find yourself talking about manure, or you find yourself talking about dead animals like I'm about to talk about. The industry calls them mortalities. And these are a regular occurrence in animal agriculture. In fact, they plan for them. It's part of their business plan. You know, you have so many mortalities in chicken business or any of the pig business. They all have a certain percentage of mortalities. But there's always something that looms out there in the distance, something called catastrophic mortalities. And I was just reading today the definition of catastrophic mortalities. This is when it overloads your systems that you expect on a regular basis. This is when catastrophic mortalities will occur because of weather events, catastrophic weather events, and electrical failure, and disease. So all these things will kill off lots and lots of livestock all at once. In the case of weather events, you know, hurricanes. Hurricane Floyd was a big story. There were, you know, drowned pigs, you know, all over North Carolina when that happened. And heat waves and floods and snowstorms and tornadoes. There was a big tornado that hit a big factory operation in Buckeye, Ohio some years ago. And that was just heartbreaking. But what do you do with the animals? I mean, first of all, it's heartbreaking, and you have all the animal activists going in and trying to rescue the animals, you know, real live animals that are caught in cages or trapped or, you know. Oh, also, there's accidents, of course, on the road. You can have, you know, an accident with a gigantic truck that has maybe many, many hundreds of, you know, chickens on it, and then they're all over the road, and what do you do with them? But anyway, the question is, what do you do with them? And there are, the industry actually, they talk very frankly about it. In fact, I might mention that the industry is very, very frank about what they do. You can look up any unsavory fact you like, and there'll be probably some scholar who has maybe staked his whole career on the subject. And so what the problem with catastrophic mortalities, which happen all the time, but you almost never hear about them, by the way. Just for example, I remember some years ago reading about a heat wave that killed literally millions. I think it was 600 million chickens in one, you know, 3 or 4 day period. It was a heat wave that just ripped across all the South. And then what you find out, you read about this in the writer's story, which is on like page, you know, 80 or whatever, and then you find out at the end that it didn't really impact the market. 600 million chickens being, you know, dying suddenly didn't impact the, because there are literally 35 million chickens that are slaughtered every day. So, what do you do with the animals? You can compost them, you can render them, you can bury them, or you can incinerate them. And in every single case, it's bad news. It's bad news for the environment. Some are much better than others. Composting is really probably the best way to do it, but you have to do it properly, and not everybody knows how to really seriously do it properly. And it can, in all these ways, can affect the environment. Burial can pollute the groundwater. Incineration will cause the oxygen to go into the air. And rendering, well, rendering is expensive, and renderers gave us mad cow, as maybe some people know, because they got very kind of overzealous with what they do, and they said, well, we can make some of these dead animals into feed for other animals, and so they were feeding essentially cows to cows. And this is the theory that this is the reason why mad cow came about. Yes, sir. Jerry.
Jerry. Was thinking that, you know, a while back I used to think that there was a very symbiotic relationship between the chicken's egg production and our eating them. You know, we sort of one hand feeds the other, you know, type thing. But what I started to realize was that what happens to the male baby chicks?
Oh.
I think it's 20 million.
Right. Well, that is kind of off topic right now, but we can talk about that. Yeah, but it's a little off topic. I'm talking about environmental impact of the meat center diet, you know, in the big, big global picture. That is probably more an issue of ethical stuff, but maybe I'll turn. I want to backtrack just a little bit because I mentioned two other ways that animals die, disease and electrical outages. As for electrical outages, just actually literally 10 minutes can wipe out, you know, maybe 20% of your flock if your electricity goes down for just that amount of time, because you need a real, you know, functioning fan systems and feeding systems and watering systems, and but particularly if the animals don't get, you know, if they burn up, you know, from heat or things like that. So electrical outages can kill a lot of animals very quickly. The other thing is disease can kill a lot of animals, and just to name a few, there are really probably like 100 animal diseases. I almost read about a new one every single week. You know, the big ones in the news and that affect lots of animals at once. Mad cow disease, of course. Literally 6 million animals, large animals, had to be destroyed in England. Foot and mouth disease, bird flu. We all know about bird flu. Literally millions of animals have to be destroyed, culled. These are the industry terms. And exotic Newcastle disease is another one, if you want to write that down to research it. So dead animals, you know, dead animals are expensive for a producer to deal with, but they are a perennial part, they're daily aspect of animal agriculture. And a lot of people just criminally dispose of them. They put their dead animals in a truck, and when nobody's looking, they dump them in the woods. You know, and then the other thing is slaughterhouses will be caught from time to time just dumping their sludge in places they shouldn't. And then what actually happens, I think the Washington Post came out with a big story some years ago about, forget the company, and that's what I don't want to say, but one of the major big chicken processing companies was dumping the slaughterhouse sludge. And then when we found out later, I mean, many months later, actually, when reporters started digging and investigating, they found out it was legal. So that's what you find out frequently, is that things that are unspeakable, things that are, you know, just egregious in every sense, you find out that there are no laws against it. And, in fact, you can bet, you know, that the lawyers at the company have already figured that out, you know. I want to talk about another really obscure one, and this is fish stocking programs. And when you probably have friends who fish, you know, and they come out in the springtime with their rod and their reel and all of that. And but have you ever asked that fisherwoman, what kind of species that they're catching, you know, and where did those species come from? Well, it's very, very likely that it was stocked. In fact, the state of New York stocks a lot of the lakes here in New York State, and they stock it at public expense. Of course, it brings a lot of tourism. I mean, when guys are fishing, women are fishing. People are moving around, they're buying things, and so the city, the state, I should say. You know, they say, well, you know, it's a small expense to pay for all of this economic activity. In fact, my husband and I, we visited a place in upstate New York. Well, it's probably downstate from here, but from us it's upstate. And we saw the whole situation. We saw a guy who explained everything about it. He showed how they have to milk the males, and they have to fertilize the females, and then they take these animals and they set them free into wild lakes. Well, I might mention that, this is one of my most startling facts, I think, in my entire book. When Europeans came here, they confronted many, 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 many lakes. In fact, apparently there are 16,000, roughly, high elevation lakes in America. 16,000 lakes. These would be in the mountains. And when Europeans came here, almost none of them had any fish at all, just reptiles and amphibians, you know, no fish at all. And when you think about it from a geological standpoint, the mountains kind of came up from the ground, and they sort of areas filled up with water, and there would be no way that fish could get in there. But today, almost every single lake in the entire country has fish. So this was, if you want to talk about invasive species, and this is what fish-eating people have done. They have brought invasive animals into this country. And one researcher I read about, he wanted to change things back again. He wanted to see if it could be done. He wanted to see if he could take all those fish out and bring it back to just reptiles and amphibians again. And it was just basically impossible. It's impossible. You can't really reverse that kind of thing. And my last one, I think it's the last one, I want to talk about dust. And here's something most vegetarians don't think about. But I do. I think about dust. I think about a lot of obscure kind of subjects because I will latch on to anything if it's... my little criteria for if it is a vegetarian issue, what I call a vegetarian issue, it's if the bad thing that comes about because of meat eating, let's put it this way, if we lived in a vegetarian world, I hold that up as the standard, vegetarian world versus today's reality. And yet today's reality is filled with problems, and many of those problems, which are, constant news in the newspaper magazines, there's so many problems, but no one ever says, essentially, what is the real cause of that problem? And it's usually somebody wants to eat animal foods. And dust is one of them. And the EPA wants to regulate dust because it's bad for your health. See, it'll give you asthma. Asthma is the biggest problem with dust. My sister actually lives in DeKalb, Illinois, which is a farm town, perhaps you've heard of. Northern Illinois University is there, but it's also a real heavy-duty farm town. They grow tons and tons of corn there, and they have lots of pig farms in the vicinity. And I remember being there visiting her, and it was a time when tractors were going, and enormous amounts of dust was being lifted up by this. Well, most people say, "Well, what can you do about it? You can't do anything about it. We need to farm so we can eat." And then that ends the discussion right there. Boom, it's over. Our elected representatives, they basically throw up their hands and says, "Well, we just can't do anything about it." But the thing is, and it harks back to sort of what I was talking about at the very, very beginning, is 70% of all grain is going to feed animals, then you have a whole lot more farming going on than, as far as we vegetarians and vegans are concerned, needs to even happen. So that's the standard, I put up there. What would vegans do? What would vegans do? So there's, just because there's a lot more farming, because you have to grow all this and cultivate all this grain so you can feed animals, so you can eat them, then you have a whole lot more dust. And that dust is causing a lot of asthma, in particular in Fresno. Was it Fresno we were reading about this morning? California, in particular, in Fresno, there is. It is the place where there's more asthma than anywhere else in the country, and it's basically a kind of a confluence of a couple of things. One of them is a lot, like 300,000 dairy farms in the vicinity. There's an enormous number of dairy farms, which actually that whole scene is changing because, other reasons. But and then mix all that dust from the dairy farms with all the hydrocarbons from L.A., and you've got a soup. You've basically got a soup that you are taking into your lungs on a regular basis. And children are particularly susceptible. People with bad immune systems are susceptible. Older people are susceptible. Everybody, people who don't have a very good immune system are going to be susceptible to asthma. I also want to mention that now dust is defined, you know, by particulate, and it's the kind of dust that farming creates is much larger particulate than the kind that the exhaust from a car would. You know, there's dust from hydrocarbons, you know, from cars, and then there's dust from, you know, soil, you know, being whipped up when it's dry. And they're both bad for your lungs. In fact, probably the hydrocarbons are worse because they get past all the defenses of your body. It's not just dust from lots and lots of farming that has to take place because you have to cultivate lots of land so you can feed the animals so you can eat them. You also have, in fact, in cities, for instance, in L.A. in particular, L.A. everybody knows is a terrible place if you have problems with your lungs. Apparently, and I can give you the reference for this, all the grilling that goes on just from people grilling hamburgers and things in L.A. Causes more hydrocarbons go into the air, and these hydrocarbons are these things that do get past the defenses of your lungs. More hydrocarbons every day than all of the city's buses. So yet another reason why we don't want to grill meat or even eat meat or have meat or, you know. So I'm going to cut it off there, and just a lot of obscure facts. I pick up these things, and I know that you guys know all of the typical reasons why a person should be a vegetarian. I know you know all those typical facts. I thought I would come here and just tell you some of the more obscure ones, the fish and the dust and manure and all kinds of fun stuff. Anyway, I love to take questions, and we can just gab all night, however long you like.
Yeah,
thank you.